Hello and welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy. I'm Chris North, and what you're about to listen to was originally broadcast as part of Pythagoras' Trousers, a science and engineering show on Radio Cardiff. You can find a full show and listen to past episodes at pythagorastrousers.co.uk. But for now, here's this month's astronomy. Well, this month Edward Gomez is back again. Welcome back, Edward.
Hi, Chris.
We're going to stay at the edge of our solar system and then push outwards to other solar systems later on. So we'll come back to the latest results from the Kepler mission later on in the programme. Well, let's start off in the edge of our solar system. We're going to go out to the Kuiper Belt. The Kuiper Belt is this dusty ring, or this icy ring of stuff out beyond the orbit of Neptune. And we know of a few objects out there there's the objects called dwarf planets like Pluto. So what do we know about general objects out there?
Well, they're frozen worlds right at the edge of the solar system. They're frozen because they're made of ice, but they're frozen also because it's very cold out there. The sun is very, very dim and distant. So the things in the Kuiper Belt and the edge of the solar system don't get much sunlight, which makes it ideal for just about nothing.
so very, they're covered in, there's presumably a little bit of water ice out there, but there's largely nitrogen ice and methane ice and all these kind of things. So things we don't find in ice form on the Earth because it's so cold.
Yeah, that's right. And it makes them quite reflective as well. That makes it slightly easier to find these things. But they are small and they're very, very difficult to find. So we don't really know that much about them, which is actually one of the things that we're looking at by sending probes into the outer solar system.
And when you say that they're hard to find, the way we find these things is that astronomers scan the sky, they look for something that moves in the front. We find asteroids nearby like that. Asteroids are much closer, of course, typically much smaller than these things.
Yeah, they also move faster as well, the ones that are close to us. So things out in the solar system, they may be moving, if you were to measure them moving, a distance of 100 metres, they may be moving faster than things that we can see close to us. But because they're so much further away, we see them tracking across the sky at a much slower rate. And that can make them a lot more difficult to find, because they may not appear to have moved very much, and so they may be missed. However, because they're moving slowly across the sky, if once you found one, it makes it a lot easier to go back and then take other observations of them.
Now, of the objects out in the Kuiper Belt, there are four which we class as dwarf planets. So there's Pluto, of course, that was reclassified back in 2006, along with Eris, and then Marky Marky, which is until recently, which we'll come on to in a second, the third largest object known out there. We also have Haumea, which is a very odd, elongated object out there.
Yeah, that's right. And we tend to think of these things as being worlds like Pluto, sort of spherical. But all sorts of things can make an object not spherical, particularly things in the asteroid belt. You think of a typical asteroid. So that's the asteroid belt between the orbit of Mars and Jupiter, not this Kuiper Belt, as being potato-shaped. And that's usually because of their size. They're not big enough for gravity to smooth out the surface. But with Haumea, it's actually something a little bit more complicated than that.
And it's because of the properties of it itself. It's actually spinning really quickly compared with other objects like that.
Yeah, so it ends up being more like a pizza. If you think of, you start with a ball of dough, and if you spin it around, it flattens out, and that's something which is happening to Haumea.
So these four dwarf planets, and lots more objects that are also fairly large, but you mentioned they're hard to find, they're also hard to characterise. They're seen as a pinprick of light, and what the brightness of that pinprick of light tells you, it tells you how much sunlight is coming from the sun out to this distance, which is 30, 50, 80 times as far from the sun as the Earth is, so a very, very long way. So the light has to go out from the sun, reflect off its object, and come back. So that depends on how much light we see is the brightness, but combined with the size of the object and how reflective it is. And those are the big unknowns, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. If it's covered in water, it's going to be, or rather frozen water, it's going to be quite reflective. If it's got a rough surface, that's going to make it less reflective. And if it's covered in other things like rock, then that's going to make it less reflective as well.
But the reason we're talking about this is there's been a measurement made, or a series of measurements made, about an object with the, not a, a proper name yet, a catalogue name of 2007 OR10, so catchy name. And that, until recently, was thought to be relatively a big object, 900 or so kilometres in size, in radius. But not one of the biggest ones in the dwarf planet, and not well enough characterised to class as a dwarf planet out there as well. The series of measurements have been by the Kepler spacecraft, which is targeting other planets in around other stars, but can also study things in our solar system, and also the Herschel Space Observatory, which is something we're involved with here in Cardiff, of course, in the astronomy group. And that's been looking at infrared light, and we learn a lot more from the infrared light than we do from the optical light that we traditionally look at.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting that you said that Kepler was looking at exoplanets. Actually, Kepler spends most of its time now not looking at exoplanets because it's broken.
Yeah.
Which is actually quite a good thing in some ways, because it's got a very, very high precision, that's very useful for finding things like this. Now, if it were working perfectly, it would only be looking at exoplanets and making exoplanet discoveries. So it's actually quite good that it's not that it's broken, but it's still usable, because one of the gyroscopes is broken on it, so it can't point as accurately as you'd need to find exoplanets, but it's good enough to find things like this.
And as you say, very accurate. So what it does is it looks at the brightness of these objects and sees them. They slowly vary with time, and that's because they're spinning. Everything in the solar system is spinning. The Earth is spinning, of course. If you looked at the Earth from afar as a dark continent of Africa went across your view compared with the relatively bright Pacific Ocean, you'd see the brightness, the amount of reflected light vary. And we're kind of seeing that with these objects as well.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly it. And really, in fact, in the early days of looking at Pluto, that was really all that we could see. You couldn't tell anything about its surface, but you could tell that there was a bright splodge that now we know is that fantastic heart shape.
Yeah. Now, the reason this is combined well with the Herschel observations are looking in the infrared, and that's looking at not the reflected sunlight, but they're just the heat emitted by this object. So it's nothing to do with how reflective it is, it's just to do with how warm it is at any given time. And so Herschel makes a kind of an independent measurement, and we can combine those two to get the brightness, how much light it's absorbing from the sun, how much it's reflecting, and therefore what it's not reflecting, it's absorbing, which heats it up a little bit, and then how much heat it gives off, then all gives us a better estimate of how big this thing is, and that's the thing that's changed.
Yeah, that's right. And so, as you said earlier, it was about 950 kilometres in size, and now the estimates are that it's about 1,500 kilometres in size. The margin for error is actually quite large on that, so it could be as low as 1,200, or it could be as high as 1,600, but still significantly bigger than it was before this analysis.
And that means, at that size, it's the third largest object we know of in the Kuiper Belt, so after Pluto and Eris. Do you think this class is a dwarf planet now? Is it?
Yeah, I think it's definitely. I mean, it's also significantly more ball-shaped than Haumea, too. So out of the dwarf planets that we know about, this is, you know, it's in an orbit around the sun and it's ball-shaped.
There's also something slightly odd about this object. It's spinning relatively slowly. Typically things out in the solar system are spinning on a matter of hours, maybe 10 hours, 20 hours, that kind of rotation period. Most of the planets have that kind of rotation period. There are some exceptions. This is spinning in about, the rotation period seems to be about 44 hours. Which is quite long, and there are a few theories as to why that might be.
Yeah, it could have all sorts of things have happened to it in its past. Could have had a collision that slowed it down. It could have a little friend that it's orbiting, or the very much like Pluto. Actually, Pluto has a moon, Charon, which is significantly of a size that's significant compared to Pluto. So actually, Pluto and Charon orbit around what's called a common centre of mass. So they don't actually go spin on an axis like the Earth does, but they spin around a point in empty space. And that could be something that 2007 OR10 is also doing. Now, if that were true, then it really changes a lot about what we know about it, because It may be that because we're looking at something so faint, the resolution of it, that what it looks like when you look at it through a telescope is a bit blurred. And so you might actually not be seeing a single thing, but two things.
Just too close together to tell
them apart.
Too
close together, yeah.
And that'll be exciting. I mean, I guess we need higher resolution observations. Kepler's not an enormous, hasn't got an enormous mirror. So the bigger the mirror, the better the resolution. So I wonder if now there'll be an effort from ground-based telescopes to try and observe this, as was done with Pluto back in, I think Charon was found in the 70s, I believe. I forget when. Decades after Pluto itself was discovered.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. This 2007 OR10 is about twice as far away as Pluto is. So this thing is, you know, really, really faint and very small. It's smaller than Pluto. Mm. So there's less of it to find, and it's also further away.
Well, who knows? In future years, we might have more observations of it. I believe it's in the opposite part of the sky to where New Horizons is going, so we're not going to go and find that, find it with New Horizons anytime soon. That's left for other smaller objects out in the Kuiper Belt. New Horizons, of course, whizzed past Pluto last summer, took all sorts of amazing pictures of it. It's also possibly reopened the argument about Pluto's status, but not with the argument that it should be a planet. It's discussing about what Pluto's role is in the grander scheme of things of the solar system.
Yeah, so we said that the Kuiper Belt is full of icy things. Now, when you think of icy things in the solar system, you naturally think of comets. And one of the things that you will know about comets is that comets have a beautiful tail behind them. So they have a tail of stuff that's coming off them, but they also have a tail of like a vortex that you get behind cars. When you think about cars or aeroplanes, you get a vortex that happens behind them. You get something very similar with everything in the solar system and the solar wind. So the solar wind is like a wind on Earth, but it's very, very thin. And it's composed of charged particles, electrons whizzing out from the surface of the sun. And these travel all the way through the solar system. They hit all the different planets. And one of the things that distinguishes planets from other things is that if you were to look from the side that is facing the sun and the side behind that's not facing the sun of any planet, you see that the speed of this solar wind is dramatically lower behind, in the dead spot behind a planet. Now, with comets, this isn't true. With comets, the speed is still quite fast. You have this like slipstream behind them. Now, Pluto is sort of halfway in between, so it's not a planet and it's not a comet, but it's more towards the comet side. So it's not that on the side that faces the sun, the side that's not facing the sun, that the speed of the solar wind drops to nothing. But it's also not a full slipstream. So
I wonder if that's just its size, maybe, the fact that it's so large. Does it have the effect of its magnetic field and so on? There could be lots of...
Yeah, that's right. So its gravity could be holding onto these particles as they whiz around it. It could be the magnetic field, probably not the magnetic field. And also the solar wind is slower out there too. So, you know, you're only looking at a drop. You're not looking at like the absolute velocity that it was travelling at.
I suppose we do normally look at comets when they're much closer to the sun.
Exactly,
than Pluto is. It really drives home the fact that although we reclassified Pluto as a dwarf planet back in 2006, or a decade ago now, and we have all these names for things, A, they don't care what we call them, and B, there's a continual variation of objects from planet down to comet, and they all just fall somewhere in between.
So. Yeah, that's right. And actually, even the planets we have are very different. We've got four that are rocky and four that are largely gassy. Mm. And so even that definition is quite flexible. Mm. So there's still bags to find out about Pluto.
We can move now to what's arguably the biggest story this month, the identification of over 1,000 likely exoplanets, planets around other stars, by the Kepler spacecraft. Kepler spent 4 years staring at 150,000 stars in one patch of the sky, between Cygnus and Vega, if you're on the lookout. It was looking for the dip in light caused by a planet passing in front of the star, very much like the transit of Mercury early this month, but much, much further away. There are many other phenomena that can cause a star's light to appear to dip, so candidate planets are generally confirmed by another telescope, generally using another method entirely, looking at the wobble of the star caused by the planet. But this is hard to do and takes a lot of telescope time. The team behind this latest result have calculated the probability that the dip in light isn't one of these other phenomena, giving each of the 1,284 newly validated planets a 99% chance of being real. It almost doubles the number of planets we know about. To find out more about what this means for exoplanet research, I'm joined by exoplanet researcher Professor Don Polacco from the University of Warwick. Don, welcome to the programme.
Hi, Chris.
So this is a great result from Kepler. Has it energised the exoplanet community to go and carry on finding more stuff, do you think?
Probably not really, because we knew there were a lot of planets out there already. What this has done, what's been really good about this, is that it's the first consistent analysis of all the objects that had variability that were found in the Kepler field. And so I think there's about 7,000 or 8,000 of those. And so what they've done here, they've applied their statistical analysis to all 7,000 or 8,000 and found something like 1,800 or so that had variability that is likely to come from a planet.
And you say likely to come from a planet because there are all sorts of other things. What kind of other things get ruled out by this analysis?
Well, they're ruled out in a probabilistic sense, right? They're not ruled out.
Right.
So it's likely not to be something else. So the sort of things that there could be is if you had, say, a binary star. And a binary star in the same line of sight as the star that could that you think hosts a planet. The overall effect of that is that you see a small dip of brightness as the stars eclipse each other. And because of the other star in the line of sight, the brightness barely varies at all. So that's a kind of thing. And while that might sound unlikely, it actually happens a lot of times.
Okay, so it's something sort of in the background that's manifesting itself. Now, I mentioned that the way these are normally confirmed, at least with previous examples, has been with another telescope, often using another method to go and stare at the same star to see the same planets there, with using another method of detection. Now, you've been involved with a number of exoplanet discovery experiments in the past, and in the future as well. Do you think that this is going to give you a list of planets that you'll target more, or is it just another batch and you'll carry on doing what you were doing before and look around the rest of the sky?
No.
So you're just going to do what you were doing before, you think?
No, but let me explain. So, and there's good reason for this. The reason that these planets have not been confirmed through this wobble technique is that you can't do it for them. And that's because they're too faint. Not only are they too faint to confirm, they're too faint to do other experiments on, like measure their atmospheres or anything like that. So what you get from Kepler, what you've always got from Kepler, the bulk of the objects are objects that you can use for a kind of statistical analysis. But you can't say anything about the planets, or almost nothing about the bulk of the Kepler planets on an individual basis. Now, after saying that, there are a few of the brightest ones, a handful of the brightest ones, where you can actually measure the Doppler signal, the wobble signal. And the reason you want to do that is that the wobble tells you about the mass of the planet. And so Kepler tells you about the size of the planet, the wobble tells you about the mass, and together you get the density. So these Kepler planets, while it's very interesting from the point of view that we know there are a lot of planets out there, we learn almost nothing about the planets themselves. So, you know, if there are small planets in there, in the habitable zone, are they rocky? Are they gassy? Well, they're probably rocky, probably, but they might not be. So it's you have to see that Kepler was a mission that was designed to do statistics, and that's what it's done.
And you're involved in other experiments to find exoplanets. Yeah. One coming up in the future is the Plato mission, from the European Space Agency, and that's also looking for the transit, but is looking for brighter stars. Is that right? So these can be followed up.
So all the experiments that we've been involved in, and Plato will be the last one, have looked at much brighter stars, or they've concentrated on bigger planets. And the reason for that is that we believe that to confirm the mere presence of a planet and to say anything about its nature, i.e. is it gassy, is it rocky, etc., then you need to be able to measure the Doppler signal. And you can only do that for the brightest stars with planets. So Plato is an evolution of what we've been doing before from the ground. Plato is really quite different to Kepler. It's made up of lots of little telescopes, all working together. And the reason it's done in this particular manner is that it gives it sensitivity to very bright stars, stars that are as bright as your eye, that you can see with your eye, in fact. And so that means we're inherently more sensitive to nearby objects. The faintest stars that Plato will see are about the brightest stars that Kepler sees. Now, to do this kind of experiment, obviously the fainter you go, the more stars there are. So to see bright stars, you have to have an incredibly big field of view. So the field of view of Plato is something like 20, 25 times that of Kepler. So it can see a lot of bright stars.
And that will tell us, as you mentioned, it will tell us a lot more about, or allow us to investigate these stars in more detail. We see results coming out not just from Kepler, but from other experiments on the European Southern Observatory's telescopes and from things like SuperWASP in the past and all these kind of other experiments about there have been the biggest planet found, the smallest planet found, the hottest, the coldest, the ones that's most like the Earth, arguably, that we've seen before.
So stamp collecting goes on.
Yeah, it's and it kind of feels like they shot their bolt already with the finding the nearest Earth-like planet, because that story has come out before half a dozen times.
Has it really?
Well, that's the good. Have we found a planet, do you think, that is really like the Earth yet?
No, we haven't. Apart from the one we're on. I mean, the reason it's the same story. The reason is that if you want to find a small planet like the Earth around a sun-like star, then firstly, the only mission that's been capable of doing that has been Kepler. But the Doppler signal is so unbelievably small in that particular case, and the stars are so incredibly faint, that to measure the Doppler signal is impossible. Oh, impossible in those particular objects with our current technology. It would take a telescope that was many, many times bigger than the biggest telescopes we're building to be able to do. So that's the idea of Plato, to find these Earth-like planets around sun-like stars that are nearby, and hence the stars are much brighter, and so we can measure the Doppler signal and hence get their masses.
So once we've got a planet, we know its Doppler signal, so we've got its mass, we know how big the transit is or how much it dims the star's light, so we know its size, we've got its density. That tells us whether it's rocky, whether it's gassy, whether it's somewhere in between that I guess we don't really understand that well yet. But what's the next step after that? We talk about characterizing the atmospheres, and we've done that for a couple of planets. How far are we from being able to look at a planet and talk about what its atmosphere is like?
That's a good question. The situation is this. The planets that we think we've looked in the atmospheres of generally have been big planets like Jupiter at very short orbits. And the issue there is that there's plenty of atmosphere. The technique to do it is very difficult. It basically involves looking during the dip in brightness as the planet moves across the star and comparing the light with the light of the star when the planet isn't moving across. And the difference tells you something about the passage of the starlight through the planet. So that's how it works in principle. In practice, it's really difficult. It's incredibly difficult to do because you're looking for very small differences between very large numbers. So that's been the most successful. Over the next few years, it's going to be different. We've now got techniques that we can actually see some planets. Now, okay, they're big planets and they're at large distances from their star, but there's planets we can see directly. So, you know, it's quite different to the way Kepler works and Plato works. They're planets we can see directly, and we can measure their atmospheres directly. But these will not be habitable planets. They will not even be habitable zone planets. They're going to be large Jupiter-sized planets in orbits like Jupiter or even further out, and they're going to be around very young stars for sure. The situation about doing planet atmosphere work around rocky planets like the Earth is a difficult one. The best hope, though, will come from Plato and its nearby planets, because in those cases, we can apply the biggest telescopes we've got and try and measure this difference in brightness, or measure the difference in the starlight when the transit occurs and when it doesn't occur. But that's still 10 years away. But I think it's probably the best hope to look for signs of habitability in exoplanets in the next 10 or 20 years.
So we've mentioned Plato a couple of times. You say Plato's about a decade away from launch?
It was a decade when we started talking about it. I don't mean in this meeting, in this interview. It was a decade when we were selected. It's now 8 years away.
Okay.
The time will go by quickly as well, for sure.
And I guess there's a lot of development there. Is it existing technology that goes into Plato? So it's kind of off the shelf, ready to plug into a satellite. I'd realize it's more complicated than plugging it in, but to put onto a satellite and then launch it, or is there a lot of technological development or technology development left to do?
Well, I thought it was pretty unambitious to start with, but it is not, believe me. Anything to do with space is always a challenge and is always difficult. In the case of Plato, the risk comes from the development and the procurement of the detectors in the satellite, and also just the sheer number of telescopes. There are 34 telescopes in Plato, 32 normal telescopes and two special ones that are used to guide the satellite with and also take data. So there's a procurement issue with all of that, and it's a big, big job. And at the end of that, you've got to integrate it as well. Once you've procured it all, you've got to integrate it into a spacecraft, and this is a big, big job. So, you know, companies like, Astrium, Airbus, they're quite used to making telecommunication satellites, but these science experiments are always different, and Plato is probably more different than most science experiments.
I guess with 24 telescopes pointing at the sky, I've got visions of a spider-like thing staring out at the sky with all its eyes. So it's going to be something to look at, I imagine. Going to be an odd-looking satellite, as you say.
It does look very strange when you see it. It's like a compound eye of a fly or something.
Well, it's looking forward to when Plato launches and gives us more planets to study in more detail and find out more about them. So, Don Polacco, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, just time to speak to Hugh Lang about the stars and planets this month and what we can see. We had Mercury transit at the start of May. Not good from Cardiff.
No, it wasn't. Unfortunately, it rained. The weather was very cloudy at any rate, so we could scratch that one, but that's unfortunate. But of course, we've still got quite a few interesting planetary objects to look at in the evening sky. Mars just passed opposition the 25th of last month.
Okay, so that's when it was brightest and
that's
closest.
That's right, closest to us. Of course, it's still very bright at the moment. It's approaching the brightness of Jupiter. Unfortunately, it's low in the sky. It's low in the south at about... well, just past midnight now, okay. It's still worth looking at. It's still a reasonably large angular size on the sky. So you've got a telescope. It's well worth going out and looking at it. And it's really bright and very red.
Yeah.
So it does stand out in the nighttime sky.
But Saturn's slightly better placed.
Yeah, Saturn is going to reach opposition on the 3rd of June, okay.
Which that means it rises at sunset, sets at sunrise.
That's right, and it's on the south ecliptic at midnight. And it's also at its closest, it's with a telescope, it's well worth having to look at. Through a pair of binoculars, you can actually see that it's at literally not a circular object. It does actually look quite distended. Through a telescope, obviously, you're going to see the rings.
Through binoculars, it's worth saying that you need to keep them steady. So rest your elbows on a wall, get a tripod or something really to see the detail.
That's right. The big thing about Saturn, okay, is with telescopes, you will be able to see a number of features if you have a reasonable telescope. But the thing to look out for is, if you have a telescope, is the ring brightening, which is a Seeliger effect, which was actually discovered by a chap called Hugo Seeliger. And he decided that what was happening is that the shadows were disappearing. And from that, he deduced that basically the rings weren't solid. They were actually made of some particular substance. He didn't know it was ice, okay, but he knew that they were particles rather than a solid form.
So this is just because the Earth, the Sun, the Earth and Saturn are all in a line.
That's right.
Exactly at opposition, exactly opposite the Sun in the sky. And that means that the shadows of the ring particles, which would darken the rest of the rings, are hidden behind those individual particles.
That's right. So therefore the ring looks brighter.
Yeah. And so that's, I only need a telescope to be able to tell that, really.
I would think so.
A subtle effect, I think it's fair to say. So of the planets, we've got Jupiter that's kind of setting in the west as the sun is setting as well. So it's still there, but
it's still very bright. Okay, it's going to be visible for the next month without too much trouble. If you have a reasonable telescope, you should be able to see all the surface features. Of course, a red spot if you're lucky. But yes, it will be sinking rapidly into the sunlight now. So it will disappear.
But then as the sun sets and the stars start to come out, the first stars you'll see will be kind of in the southeast. You've got what's called the summer triangle, three bright stars.
That's right. That's composed of Deneb, Vega and Altair. Deneb, obviously, in Cygnus the Swan, Vega in Lyra, and Altair in Aquila the Eagle. And of course, they compose the summer asterism, the summer triangle.
Yeah. Directly overhead is the Plough, and then sort of low to the north, Cassiopeia, the W.
That's right. And of course, if you follow the Plough down towards the south, you'll come to another bright star, Arcturus, which is part of Biotes. Okay, and if you carry on then, that'll actually lead on to the bright white star, which is Spica on the ecliptic in the constellation of Virgo.
And as the sun sets, which is, we're talking about 10 p.m. now.
That's right.
By the time these stars come out, if you're seeing Arcturus, then roughly down and left of that is going to be Mars.
That's correct.
Which is also
red. That's
course.
Right, very red. Yeah. Very bright, but of course it's quite low to the horizon, unfortunately, Mars.
And then between Arcturus and Vega, we've got the trapezium shape of Hercules.
That's right, the square of Hercules, of course, associated with the great globular cluster discovered by Messier M13, which is well worth looking at with a telescope.
And as I've got a fairly small telescope, and it's well worth looking at.
Definitely.
Through a telescope. It's quite nice to look at. So although the nights are short and the summer skies are coming in, there is still a lot to enjoy, and of course it's a bit warmer.
That's right, so it's a good time to look up.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. It was originally broadcast on Radio Cardiff as part of Pythagoras' Trousers.